I wasn't ready to like reveal everything. I was just like, there is no way I'm going to tell people about being a sex addict. There's just no way.
What's good? I'm Nikisha Elise Williams, and this is Black and Published, bringing you the journeys of writers, poets, playwrights, and storytellers of all kinds. Today's guest is K.E. Garland, author of the memoir In Search of a Salve, Memoir of a Sex Addict. It's a book that forced Kathy to confront the traumas of her past and how they impacted the life she built with her husband and two daughters to finally live in her truth.
People have said this to me. Well, if you're going to cheat, then why lie about it? Well, if you're going, why don't you just get a divorce? Why don't you just tell the truth? And I'm like, come on, y'all. Some of y'all came and tell your auntie you don't like the potato salad when you go home. So don't try to, it is not, truth telling is not easy on any level.
Confronting the truth with the ones you love and walking out a future free of lies is no easy feat. Kathy explains how she and her husband are doing now that she's revealed her darkest secrets to the world. Plus, how she learned to have compassion for herself and her family despite the many traumas she experienced. And the reason she says the rest of her life will be dedicated to writing instead of working hard. That and more is next when Black and Published continues. All right, so let's jump in. When did you know that you were a writer?
I want to say that I knew intuitively that I was a writer when I was about 10 years old. My fifth grade teacher had entered me into this contest. I had written this book called On the Farm, and I had created an actual book. I guess I was like self-publishing at 10 years old. And my fifth grade teacher thought it was so great. She entered it into this contest that it was somehow associated with Gwendolyn Brooks. And I didn't win, but I think I knew then that I was a writer. But then, you know, like life happens and things occur. So writing wasn't like a priority, right? And especially, I like to say, especially not in a Black household, mm-hmm. where those things are sometimes seen as like, oh, that's cute. Or, oh, yeah, you can write and you were nominated for an award. But like, what you gonna do to pay bills, right? So I want to say 10. But the actual answer, when I knew it in my gut, was about 2014 is when it was. A friend of mine had asked me to write something about going natural. And I stumbled across For Harriet and I submitted. And I'm waiting. So because I'm a scholar, I'm used to when you submit to scholarly journals, it takes literal 2 years to hear from someone. And then they might say, maybe. And if you change X, Y, and Z, and if you do blah, blah, blah. So I'm thinking that's what's going to happen. No, Kim was like, yes, already published. And I was like, what? It was already on the site, like that day. And then, you know, over the week, it's like thousands of likes and then people commenting and saying stuff like whatever. They understood what I was talking about. And I just immediately, I was like, oh, shit, I was supposed to be a writer. Like, it was just so clear. I was like, oh, I think I was supposed to be a writer. I'm supposed to be writing and saying stuff to people. And then that's how it started.
So then, I mean, you said earlier, like, you know, after 10 years old, because of lifing, mm-hmm. it wasn't a priority. In 2014, after that article went live and I guess went low-key viral, did you start making writing a priority?
I absolutely did. And I remember sitting there thinking, I wish somebody would just pay me to like read and write. I'm like, that's everybody's fantasy, right? If you're a writer. But I was like, that would be so cool. Somebody would just pay me to just read and write all day long. I would love that. And so then I started, you know, of course, I'm not saying that doesn't happen. I know that happens for some people. But at my big age, as they say, I have.
I was waiting for it.
Right. I have, you know, responsibilities. We got mortgages and car notes over here. So I knew I couldn't quit my job, But I did know that I had to find ways to prioritize it because it was that it was just so clear to me, like, oh, yeah, I have to do this.
And so then what did that look like?
The first thing it looked like was changing from, I was at a research institution and the demands there are very high. And I was doing it on top of commuting there. But basically, I was driving home on a commute one time. And my youngest daughter was like, you know, when's the next time you're going to be, you know, on campus? And I told her, I said, the next time I'll come here, it's going to be to move my shit because I'm leaving. And I didn't know what that meant. I know what it looked like, but I just knew. And then like a day later, a colleague of mine at a community college was like, do you want a job? I was like, I do, actually. Right.
Yeah,
I do, actually. Yeah. And she was like, you don't want this job. I was like, no, I really do. Like, give it to me. So that job, it was at a different level. I teach 5 classes, but 4 of them are online. So I had plenty of time. And because it was at a different level, what I like to tell people, and I know it sounds arrogant, but I could teach these classes in my sleep because of my background and my degrees. And so that's what I needed to be able to be the type of writer I wanted to be.
I know it's not on the book cover, which we discussed, and you don't really let people know, but Kathy is a doctor, y'all. So she got that whole PhD behind her name, even though she don't want to, you know, play into respectability politics and whatnot. We'll get there later.
Right.
Anywho, just have to let the people know. So then taking a position at a lower level to prioritize your passion for writing, what were the kinds of things that you were writing before you decided, you know, maybe I should move into books?
So before that, I was blogging a lot. And it was, so all these things were happening at the same time. I'm quitting a job. And also I want to add that because I don't like it when people make things sound like they're super easy. I didn't just change positions. I took a whole pay cut where I was making, I want to say, at least $30,000 less than what I was making. I know it hurts every time I say it. It's painful. But I made that decision so clearly. So at the same time, I also eventually, like 2015, started like healing all this trauma. And I'm healing it, though, through blogging. So even though I'm like saying, yes, I'm going to do this to help other people, and it does help other people, I'm really like pouring my heart out online, really for myself, and also to like kind of create community. The blogging world is really, really compassionate. You can really find your people there. And so I would, no matter what I would talk about, I'm talking about, you know, some heavy things. And there's always somebody like, oh, I felt the exact same way. And I wish somebody would have said this.
I have never heard the internet described as compassionate, especially in the comment section. Child, you must be in a different corner than the rest of us.
I'm telling you, go to WordPress. It's like, I always feel like it's a warm hug.
All right. And so then I know from your blog, quoted, and that's with a K and a W. you talk in your book about having an essay in Chicken Soup for the Soul and your book, The Unhappy Wife, and some other projects that you've done. Why was that not enough? Because, I mean, if you are telling your life online, you're basically giving the memoir, spoiler alert, that you were like, you know what? It needs to be from start to finish about what's really going on with me.
Yeah, because what I was doing was like kind of protecting myself and my identity, really, if I look back at it, especially on the blog. So like the title of the book is got sex addiction in it. I have not once said anything on my blog about that. So I will talk about adoption. I will talk about being married. I'll talk about how sometimes your friends suck. What I have never talked about is any type of addiction or any inkling that I would have had that particular issue. I hadn't even talked about drinking a lot. And so I felt like if I'm going to actually be true and authentic, then I think if I put these pieces together, people will get like a holistic understanding.
So we're going to start talking about your publication process. And for full disclosure, Kathy did publish under my company, New Reads Publications. But before we get there, when did you start writing what will become In Search of a Sow?
As soon as I had what I define as a rock bottom moment. So in that book, I describe like sitting on a porch, I think, or patio and answering this one question. And I think the question was something like, what do you fear is true or something like that about yourself? And as soon as I answered that question, I'm like, boo-hoo crying. But after that, I start writing. I'm like, why do I feel this way? And I really started writing it right like that day. I think the first sentence is like later in this book now. It was something like, books were my sustenance. That was the very first sentence I wrote because I was thinking like, how did I get to this point? Not just with all of the things, but like, I'm not reading for enjoyment. I'm not writing anything. I'm not doing things that I like. How did I get here? So I started writing in 2014. And then I kept remembering things like, oh, then this happened. Oh, then my mother did this. And then it started kind of being pieced together. But still, like with your earlier question, I wasn't ready to like reveal everything. I was just like, there is no way I'm going to tell people about being a sex addict. There's just no way. And not in 2014, definitely. So my first iteration of that book was called Petulia, which was my birth name. And so it was just going to be about adoption. Like, this is just going to be a story about adoption and how adoption affects people and blah, blah, blah. But then I kept remembering stuff. And then I read Melody Beattie's Codependent No More. And I was like, oh, no, I'm codependent. And that's what's wrong. But then I thought, no, there like came a time I was like, oh, no, I'm going to have to write about sex addiction. But still, it wasn't In Search of a Sow. I was going to write it like an epistolary, like I had this diary and it was going to be called Diary of a Sex Addict. Right. But it was going to be like me confessing to my husband, like, oh, I've been trying to tell you something, but, you know, here it is. But that wasn't. And I rewrote it each time. I'm like rewriting this book. So I have like all these different versions. Right. Looking like that. That's why he was like, I need more. I'm like, oh my God, if I rewrite this thing one more time. But that's what, yeah, I have like literal thousands of word versions of each one. Wow. Because each time I'm like, no, this is not right. No, this is not right. And then once I decided, but even the diary part, it wasn't right either because I hadn't kept a diary. It was kind of inauthentic. You know, you have to, you like crossing over into fiction when you do stuff like that. And I wanted it to be as real as life.
Baby, mission accomplished. Because when I got it, I said, ma'am, we can do some things. Oh, but actually, what I first said to you was, it's too good for me to publish. If you want me to help you find an agent and go the traditional route, let me know. And you were like, no. And I was like, huh? Because I was like, I didn't think I could do it. I really didn't. So for those that are looking to publish, a lot of people may only think about big five deals or self-publishing. And there's a myriad of things in between, which is where I guess my little company lays with Vanity Boutique Publishing, right? So why was it that was something that you wanted to do when I still think you could have gone a different way?
So two answers. The first part is, and I think this book shows this, I was raised with valuing so much, like valuing being like the top, right? So I attended these magnet schools where that's the push. The push is like, you are the best and you better act like it. You're supposed to go out in the world and do great things. And so I lived in that, which is why I ended up driving hundreds of miles twice a week to go to a research institution, right? Because it's like, oh, I belong here. And I don't care what y'all say. I know I'm supposed to be here. But all of that, you know, you end up burnt out. You end up doing things that are not aligned with your spirit. And by this time, I was like, I am not about to work hard anymore. And I don't mean that to say that I'm not going to work and do the best that I can. Right. Like, there's a difference between pushing like a rock uphill as opposed to being in alignment and then working hard for that when you know it's supposed to be. And so a lot of my life was focused on like academics and being the best. And I was like, yeah, I don't have anything to prove to anyone. Again, I earned a PhD from an R1. I'm not proving shit else. I'm tired. And so that was the first part. The second part is because I've read a lot about like the differences between, you know, indie and traditional and vanity and blah, blah, blah. And I know that I'm a good writer. I don't think that because I went with you, that means I don't have a good book or that I'm not a good writer. And I think sometimes that's what people think. So that's the first part. But I get what you were saying, because you weren't just saying like, oh, it could be published here. You were saying like some of it is resources, right? You don't necessarily, when you go with a certain publisher, that person doesn't have the resources that like a Simon & Schuster would have. So I get that part. But
shout out to my publisher.
Right. But I also know there are other things that can happen, right? So, for example, we published this book. Somebody else could read it and pick it up and do a repub. So I just know that there are other possibilities. And actually, there's three answers. Like I said before, I wanted somebody Black and female to work with me. And I didn't want to chance it. You know, you go to a publisher and of course they might have one Black person. That person might be female. That person, you know, so just because you brown doesn't mean that you're going to read my words and get it. And so I had interacted with you in different ways that you didn't know. I've been vetting you for like a year.
Unbeknownst to me.
Right. You had no idea that I'm like stalking you on social media, reading stuff that you've written online, trying to see who you are, listening to this podcast that now I'm on. I mean, who knew? But I was like, oh no, she's okay. And then, you know, reading a book that you had already published. So all of those things, I didn't go into this lightly. I was like, no, it has to be a very specific person. And you are the person.
Okay.
The end.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. That I didn't know any of that because, you know, I'd be over here minding my business, child.
Mm-hmm.
So then once we got into the publishing process and you talk about having to me telling you, I need more and making you go back and go back and go back. What was that like for you personally, having to dig that deep and put even more detail and pull out even more of those memories and really give them life on the page?
It was so much. And I was over here cussing you out constantly.
I'm sure.
It was a lot, but it was good. So I have to say, a lot of people think, well, let me back up. I'm a solo writer. Like, I know a lot of writers have writing groups and do all the things. And because I'm also a blogger, I'm used to like eking out something and press and publish and trusting my gut. And so I told people all throughout this process, it was actually good because I think I have 40,000 words. And when we first met, you were like, that's kind of light. And you know, I'm always bucking people. So I'm like, I don't have to write that many words for somebody to get what I'm saying. And you just looked at me like I was nuts. And so I was like, okay. So eventually, once I got that, you know, my head wrapped around it, I was like, this is good, because I would have, if I was doing this myself, like a true self-published, I probably would have press published, you know, and sent it out at 40,000 words. But honestly, it wasn't right. That wouldn't have been okay. And I remember you saying, you're asking a reader to take a journey with you. And I was like, yeah, this is true. So the reader deserves the best. So it was really hard though. Because I honestly thought that I had processed everything and that it was all ready and I was good. And so there were some parts, like specifically, I remember you saying, like, you seem to like have like more compassion for your dad than you do for like your mother and your grandmother. And why is that? And I had to really like sit and thought, like, oh, why? I don't know. I didn't even realize that. Why is that? It was hard. It was a lot of like more crying, where I had to not only come to terms with, oh, this is how I really feel about this person, but then deciding, like for a memoir, you got to decide, are you going to actually say that on the page for all to see?
Well, since we're here now and you've already told it all, go ahead and get a little Black and Published audience just a little taste of this memoir of a sex addict that you've written here.
K.E. Garland's memoir, In Search of a Salve, explores Kathy's first introduction to sex from the time she was a little girl and the central role it played in her life as she navigated her fractured family and loneliness by seeking the attention of men. Raw, honest, and at times heartbreaking, this memoir of a sex addict adds context to the salacious physical acts while exploring how to heal to finally come out on the other side. Here's Kathy.
So at this point, my mother has died. I have been shipped away to live with my grandmother in another state, in like a little country town. And I'm 17 years old. And my father has given up his parental rights, even though there was absolutely no reason to do that. Eddie and I should have separated after the third pregnancy. For some reason, I couldn't, and I leaned into the opposite action. I told him when he graduated, we could get an apartment. I fantasized with him about marrying and having kids. It was a grand narrative with which I conspired and filled with bold lies. Grandma Honey would never allow me to move into an apartment with a boy while pursuing a degree she and my grandfather paid for. Furthermore, if I wanted to have his children, I could have by now. I didn't want to, and I really didn't want him. In year two, Eddie graduated and began to fulfill the first part of our pledge. He attended a business college in the same town where I was. He'd rented an apartment less than 15 minutes away, but I'd met a new boy. His name was Will. He was from Detroit. It was his first year. He was an education major like me. His birthday was in May, like mine. He was an only child like me. His glasses were as thick as the bottom of a throwback Coke bottle, but that was okay. Our meeting was destined. Will and I had sex within the week. Like Kenny and Trey, he pumped and panted on top of me while I lay there daydreaming. My relationship with Eddie lingered in the background. Our commonalities meant Will and I were supposed to be together. However, other parts of our connection proved otherwise. The first incident was when Will's favorite cousin, Tammy Jr., came to campus. I'd never heard of a girl being a junior, but Will said she was named after her mother. Tammy Jr. had protected him throughout childhood, which explained how he made it unscathed with his glasses in a Detroit public school. "She's meeting us at the football game," he said. "Don't be nervous. As long as you don't do anything to hurt me, she's cool." Tammy Jr. and Will sat next to each other behind me. I stared at the field in silence. "What you tell her? She looks scared to death," she laughed. "Just told her not to do anything to piss you off." Clarity is oftentimes presented in spurts. Flashes of intuition beg to be heard. Sitting at that football game in front of Tammy Jr., I suspected Will wasn't my forever love. But like my continued relationship with Eddie, I feared a breakup. I didn't want to be alone. Will and I took a semi-independent road trip to Chicago. He and I drove the marquee my grandparents had given me while my grandparents trailed behind. We popped a cassette tape in and sang Shy's If I Ever Fall in Love in perfect harmony. "Rewind that. Let's sing it again," he urged. "And if I," I began. "No, like it was the last time," he whined. "I did sing it like last time." "No, you didn't," he said and pressed stop. We drove in silence for the remaining hour. The road trip confirmed my feelings, but we remained in a relationship. For another getaway, Will took me to his home in Rosedale Park. He'd spoken about his military retired father and beautiful mother with such fondness that I couldn't wait to meet them. "So, you're from Chicago?" his mother asked as she handed me a bathrobe to cover up my pajama shorts. "Yes," I said, tying the sash. "So tell me, do you prefer Neiman Marcus or Lord & Taylor?" What a strange question. In general, my mother shopped at a store called Venture, a place that sold stale pizza and clothes. It's where I received my first relaxer. If she was fancy, then we'd go to JCPenney. We went to Marshall Field's to splurge and Neiman Marcus when red tags signaled there was something she could afford. Neiman Marcus, I answered, because they have more sales. I sensed the answer was inadequate for her monogram bath towels and petite hand soap. The four of us stared at the television. Will and I sat on the couch, backs aligned with their taut sofa, chins tucked. His parents sat in Victorian-style armchairs. The next day, we saw a movie, and then his parents drove us back to campus. Will and I argued constantly. One day, he was so infuriated that he hurled an apple onto my dorm wall, scaring the shit out of me. Most of the apple fell, but a lot of chunks hung onto the white stucco for the remainder of the semester, symbolic of our union. His friends thought I was being abused, so they told a professor who happened to be friends with my grandmother. "Are you okay?" she asked. I assured my grandmother I wasn't being abused, and I grew less fond of Will as the semester wore on. I began to strategize. I'd wait until Christmas break and slowly cease communication when we returned for classes after the new year.
How did you learn to have compassion for yourself through all of your experiences, multiple pregnancies, relationships, the hiding, the lying? How did you give yourself that grace?
I didn't until maybe the last 2 years. I think I was still judging myself. And over time, I learned to give myself compassion, mainly because I interact with so many different types of people that I have really learned that each and every one of us has something that we're hiding. So that kind of helped me to think like, oh, okay, like, why am I trying to hide this thing? I shouldn't feel bad about this when everyone's doing something. That's the first part. But really, just in the past 2 years, I think, and especially with finalizing this particular project, reading it, I started to feel more empathy for myself, because the more, I think, iterations you have, the farther away, like now I read this and I'm like, who is this girl? But also, right, because it's like, it doesn't even feel like me. So the farther I am from it too, the more I'm able to be like, poor her, right?
And I feel like that sentiment, that poor her feeling, is very pronounced when you talk about being adopted. First of all, you throw that in there so smooth. It's like, what the fuck? It's like, we've gone through so much to the point. And then you like, oh, and I'm adopted. It's like, wait, what?
Yeah.
We got to
back it
all the way up, right?
Yeah.
And, and then you begin to break down your biological family history and how that's compounded on your adoptive family history. And almost like you do this break in character between who you are and who you could have been if you were raised by your biological family. One, where did that idea come from, just as a writing technique? Because I was like, I have never. And then two, was that really how you saw yourself?
Mm-hmm. It absolutely was. So the first thing is I want the reader to feel like I felt when I found out I was adopted. Because that's how it felt.
Mission accomplished.
Because that's how it was when I found out. Like, huh? I'm what?
I'm laughing, but I still remember. It was like a kick to the head. He was like, wait, what?
Yeah. And on top of everything else, then there's this. Right. Yeah. And then it's also like this idea of, we'll just keep moving on. And so I wanted it to kind of be like that. Like, yeah, this is how I found out. And now let's continue the story. But also, like, adoptees, it's common for adoptees to have like these identity issues where we're always thinking about, they call it a ghost family. And I learned that on
This Is Us.
Watch. Yeah. Mm-hmm. When he did that, and I was like, oh my God, I used to do the same thing. Where you're sitting, you have all these scenarios, like my real family is this, and this is what we would be doing. And so I felt so affirmed when I saw that episode. Like, I didn't know that was a thing. That had been something I was doing my entire life, like having this split identity. Once I found out, it's like you think about, well, where are these people and who are they? And did I see them at the grocery store or something? Or, and then you have like, because you have to not be thinking about that constantly. But then there came a time, you know, with processing where I did have to sit and I had to think about, yeah, who would I have been? Like, let's be realistic, girl. You couldn't have been raised by this biological mother. It just was not going to work. And quite honestly, not even my biological father, who now I'm in contact with. I'm like, neither one of y'all was, it just wouldn't have worked. So yeah, I wanted the reader to feel all of that, how you fantasize, but then you got to bring it back to reality.
So okay. You mentioned earlier that you had the anthology, The Unhappy Wife, that you are a wife, you are still married, you have two children, and your book is about sex addiction. And there is a reckoning point that you have with your husband, with your spouse, in the book that you detail. How has it been since that, you know, full revelation, and now that the book is out? Because I know when we started working together, you were like, "Yeah, he's already told me, yeah, like, I'm not reading this book."
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So he has changed his mind, and. Your face. I wish people could see your face. So he has changed his mind, but also just to make you laugh, I told him, I said, well, you can read part 1 and 2 and 4. We're going to skip 3. You don't need to read that. So I literally went through and redacted with a big black marker on both sides because I was like, nope. I said, and so he was like, well, you don't have to do that. And I said, you know, you're right. I probably didn't have to do that. Because we are two different people. So like, if it was me and you told me not to read something, I would like read the first part and be like, oh, I can read this. And so he said, no, I'm not doing that. He said, because I don't want to know. And he said, if you told me I'm not supposed to, he said, I don't want details. I don't want to know whatever. And I was like, okay, cool. So he says he's going to read it.
Parts 1, 2, and 4.
Right.
Only.
He has been given. He has been given his directives and he's going to follow them. And the CSAT person I was telling you about, she told me at first, she was like, he doesn't need to read that. That's not the way to go. And I told her the 1, 2, and 4 part. And she was like, well, he could read that. She was like, he could do that. But yeah, definitely don't read part 3. So.
At all.
Absolutely not. Right. So that's his plan. And we will see how that goes. But to answer the question about like, how has it been? It's been a lot. And it's been a lot for, this is the first time that I've thought, well, maybe we need to go to like couples therapy or something, because he was having a hard time, of course, like that's to put it lightly. And because of his personality, I think he thought, well, I know, he thought that he was going to be able to, like, I tell you this stuff and then you just get over it in 3 days, because that's what has happened before.
Which is illustrated in the book.
Right. But 2 years later, yeah, like we, to be honest, like to be totally honest, it'll be like 1 week we having a whole divorce conversation. And I'm like, okay, am I going to stay in this house or what am I going to do? And the next week we like, you know, at the beach celebrating our anniversary, you doing. It's very.
Posting thirst traps on Instagram.
I told my sister, I said, our little bipolar relationship, I don't know. So like, but it's, guess what it's been. But I hate to say it, it's actually a better relationship because there's no, nothing. Like he knows who I am. I know who he is. I'm clear about it. He's had to do kind of like what I had to do with him, which is, you know, once you know things more clearly, then you think back like, oh, well, now I remember that one time when this happened. Oh, is that? Oh, OK. So back in that. But, you know, he's going through the years. And I'm like, I don't know about when I come down for breakfast, if he in 1995 or if we here or so it has been a lot. And I don't want people to think just because I'm like laughing. It really has been a lot. That's my answer. It's a lie.
I'm not lying.
And I see why people lie.
We'll see why you lied.
Yeah, because who wants to go through? Like, I really do for a long time. And people will say this. And I don't know if when people read the book, they're going to say this. But people have said this to me. Well, if you're going to cheat, then why lie about it? Or if you're going, why don't you just get a divorce? Why don't you just tell the truth? And I'm like, come on, y'all. Some of y'all came and tell your auntie you don't like the potato salad when you go home. So don't try to, like, it is not, truth telling is not easy on any level.
So then with that said, what do you want readers to take from all of this truth that you told, not just about yourself? Because yes, it's your dirt, but it also talks about how compounded trauma and then remaining silent about it does the body and the mind no favors. So what do you want readers to take from, I think, that aspect of the book beyond just the salacious details of the sex addiction?
People are going to take from it wherever they're coming from. So like this one reviewer, I know she's adopted. She's like transracial adoption. And so I could tell from her review, that's what she focused on. She focused on this idea of having compassion for, you know, your birth parents or for your origin family, right? That was her whole review. Whereas somebody else's, you know, is something else. Even talking to, oh, you might find this interesting. So my youngest daughter finished the book recently and she was like, so I have a list of 22 questions and I'm gonna come over and talk. This is my daughter. So she was like, I'm gonna come over and talk to you about it. And she did. And we talked for an hour and a half and it was great. It was not anything. It wasn't what I thought it was going to be. It was her telling me some of her secrets that she would think that I would be, you know, angry about. It was her kind of affirming some things that women go through that I didn't think were common, like losing your virginity, or even the part that I read, like whereas you, some women feel like those first encounters, those sex encounters are like, oh, is this just what, is this some dude kidding on me? That seems to be common. I'm not saying it's common for her. I'm just saying that we talked about stuff like that. And so to answer your question, I think that whatever, I know that wherever the reader is, that's what they're going to get from it.
Let's go to the speed round in the game before we wrap up for the afternoon. Okay. Dr. Kathy, what is your favorite book?
My favorite book is Jesmyn Ward's Men We Read.
Who is your favorite author?
I don't know if I have a favorite author. It was Terry McMillan for a really long time, mainly because she, I think, just showed that you don't have to write one way. And also, you don't always have to have like some greater, you know, you can just write a story because you like the story and it reflects people. So I wouldn't say she's my favorite, but she definitely showed me some things.
What do you think is the best book to movie adaptation?
Life of Pi. I really like that. Yeah, I really like the book and I really enjoyed the movie.
Is there any author that whose work you read and you'd be like, you know what? I have retired from writing. You just want to burn your notebook.
Oh, man. I would say, yeah, I would go back to Jesmyn Ward. Like, I think she does a really good job of putting like these concepts together, but telling this story to prove a point, which, of course, is what a memoir is supposed to do. But she does it so skillfully. It's like, I don't know. It's like almost like you didn't. I'm like, oh, OK, because you get so lost in the story. And that's kind of what I envision. Like, I want people to get lost in the story, but still have this point, right? Like,
yeah, take something away from it.
Right.
If money were no object, where would you go? What would you do? And where would you live?
So I have actually been thinking about this because we started doing like these long, like these 8-week stays overseas. And yeah, and it actually works out really well. So I'm going to speak from like doing that. Costa Rica was, I think it's a place that I could actually live if somebody would fund that for me. That would be great. Yep. Costa Rica, any part of it. It was just it's full of brown people. You know, they speak Spanish. The food is good. There's beaches. Like, what else
do you really need?
Yeah.
Okay. I agree. What would you be doing in Costa Rica?
I think just kind of like waking up and maybe writing, maybe not. I'm like looking forward to just doing, like waking up and doing what I want at some point.
Name three things on your bucket list.
Oh, I don't have a bucket list because I kind of like, I really don't. I like have ideas and then I just kind of make them happen because, you know, you have this one life.
Amen.
Maybe.
Mm. What brings you joy? I'm not doing this with you today.
Oh, what brings me joy? Let me see. It brings me joy when I feel like I have helped someone in any type of way. Like I really get excited about that. When people reach out and tell me that, even like with this book, before it even came out, I've had like people DM me like, oh my gosh, I think I've had this problem and I can't wait for the book to come out and for you to even say it out loud is helpful. And I'm like, oh, okay. Like who knew? So yeah, I just think helping people in any type of way. Yeah.
And what brings you peace?
Lately, like telling the truth. It's like, it's scary. It's scary, but it really is the most peaceful thing to not have the burden of holding on to things that you think people shouldn't know.
Well, all right, then. We're going to switch to our game, Rewriting the Classics. Name one book you wished you would have written.
A book I wish. Oh, you know what? The Coldest Winter Ever, Sister Soldier. I don't know why. I just love that book so much. And it was at such a pivotal like moment. But yeah, I think that would be.
I was not expecting that. But amen.
I'm diverse, Nikisha Elise Williams.
I think every Black person has read The Coldest Winter Ever. And if you haven't and you're listening to this podcast, turn it off and go read it right now, post-haste.
Right. Black card revoked if you have not.
Right. That just wasn't the answer that I was expecting. And not that I had an expectation. That just wasn't on my bingo card today. Name one book where you want to change the ending and how would you do it?
Yeah, I don't think I have one where the ending needs to be changed. I really don't.
Okay. Yeah. Name a book that you think is overrated and why.
As a former English teacher, I don't understand why we are relegated to Shakespeare every year. Why does everybody, like any Shakespeare, anything he's written, he or she has written, just take it down. He's not even American. I don't understand why we're reading that in America, like as the, you know, no.
Would you trade Shakespeare for August Wilson?
Sure. I would absolutely.
Okay. So then final question. Mm-hmm. When you are dead and gone and among the ancestors, what would you like someone to write about you and the legacy of words and work that you've left behind?
I hope that they say she showed us how to tell the truth.
Big thank you to K.E. Garland for being here today on Black and Published. Make sure you check out Kathy's memoir, In Search of a Salve, Memoir of a Sex Addict, out now from New Reads Publications. And if you're not following Kathy, follow her on the socials. She's at K.E. Garland on Instagram and Twitter. That's our show for the week. If you like this episode and want more Black and Published, head to our Instagram page. It's at Black and Published. And that's BLK and Published. There, I've posted a bonus clip from my interview with Kathy about why she didn't and still doesn't go to therapy despite her addiction and all the trauma she's experienced in her life. Make sure you check it out and let me know what you think in the comments. I'll holler at y'all next week when our guest will be Lamia H., author of the memoir Hijab Butch Blues.
It didn't feel possible for me to not be Muslim because I find these ideas so compelling. And so then to me, it became a question of, well, how do you carve out a space for yourself within this religion? And, you know, it's really funny because I actually think about this all the time in terms of queerness, too.
That's next week on Black and Published. I'll talk to you then. Peace.